Hi there. We're so glad you're with us. My name is Lauren Shahadi, and you're listening to The Podium from Vox Media and NBC Sports. Today's episode, it's going to be a lot of fun. One of my favorite parts of the Winter Olympics is watching the action sports. I don't know how many of you feel that way, but that's one of the things I can't wait for in Pyeongchang. And coming up, a look at how action sports, and specifically snowboarding, went from being almost a fringe pastime to one of the most popular Olympic events. Sure, there's a high degree of difficulty, right? But along with that comes exceptional performances that we get a front row seat to. I got my guy, reporter Tim Struby, with me, who's really been able to dive in on the evolution of action sports. And it seems like they've come a long way. Hi, Tim. Am I right?
Well, Lauren, good to see you. Action sports certainly have come a long way. And back in the 80s, I was actually living in the Rocky Mountains and I was snowboarding. And most of the mountains in Colorado, as well as America, had banned snowboarding from it. It was considered dangerous. It was considered a fad. Skiers frowned upon it. Yet this kind of group of snowboarders, the few people who were doing it, considered themselves countercultural rebels and sort of an anti-mainstream movement. But now, turn the clock ahead.
Sure.
It is certainly mainstream and is front and center at the Olympics.
I just want to get one thing clear. In the 80s, I had a pacifier in my mouth. But it's easy not to make you feel old.
Thank you.
It's easy to be front and center, though, in the Olympics world, I would imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, when you keep raking in the medals, that's the case with Team USA.
Yeah, absolutely. Since snowboarding became a sport at the Olympics in 1998, the U.S. snowboarding team has dominated. They've won 24 total medals. And it's certainly worth taking a closer look at how we got there.
I'm curious about the term action sports. Is that a way of grouping, I don't know, sports that don't fall under another umbrella? Explain it to me.
It somewhat is. As a layman myself, I took it upon myself to catch up with Todd Richards, who we'll hear from shortly, to address that very question. Todd was a professional snowboarder and one of the pioneers in the sport. He was also one of the first competitors in the 1998 Winter Olympics in snowboarding. And he also happens to be an NBC analyst for the 2018 Winter Olympics.
Look, I mean, action sport is a term that they coined to us as these alternative sports. They didn't know what to call us. You know, are they, you know, instead of calling us wacky sports, they called us action sports. And action sport can be applied to anything that maybe goes against the norm these days, whether it be, free skiing or snowboarding, skating, BMXing. They're the alternative sports. Skiing has been around for a really long time. But, you know, it kind of took the influence of snowboarding to turn these guys in a different direction and the way that they looked at doing freestyle on the hill. The most important thing is that what is the sensation you get from either sliding sideways down the hill or skiing and coming into a jump backwards and flipping over three times. That's the important thing. It doesn't matter what they call us. It's all about what the feeling is once you leave the lip.
Well, we're going to get a lot of action sports at this Olympics. A lot of flying down, jump backwards, because there are 12 disciplines at this Olympics that are considered, in quotes, action sports that come under the freestyle skiing and snowboarding. But you know about, tell us about, Lauren, about your snowboarding experience.
Wait, I'm laughing because I was listening to Todd talk about the sensation you get from sliding sideways down a hill. And my sensation's
yes.
fear.
Are you ready for that?
Are you kidding me?
Have you done?
That's why I'm talking to you and not on the hill.
Well, maybe we can try that when we go to South Korea. To be honest, I mean, I have done it for a good portion of my life. And, you know, it's so much fun to do. And it's just thrilling to watch. And it's really drawn in a lot of fans. And more importantly for the Olympics, it's drawn in younger fans. And that's what the Olympics has been really, really looking to do, is capture kind of a new demographic. And it's just so relatable. And we talked to an expert about that very subject, is Kelly Clark, who is an old friend of mine, a subject I wrote about many years ago, a snowboarding legend who's won over 70 career times in contests and is about to compete in her fifth Winter Games. So we've got more from her coming up in the show, but I really asked her about what makes snowboarding so popular and so easy to relate to.
You know, snowboarding has been such a successful Olympic sport because it's relatable. If someone goes outside and plays catch with their dad, they don't call themselves a baseball player. But if they go snowboarding with their family on the weekends, they call themselves a snowboarder. There's a culture of relatability that goes along with snowboarding that has helped it be so successful. And I think, in my mind, the more people who experience snowboarding and who get to enjoy snowboarding because of the Olympics, that's a win for the sport. It's caused it to grow, and it's caused it to become more acceptable.
So, Lauren, we're going to take a look at how it went from being alternative to acceptable and some of the big moments in the history of that chronology. There are some big personalities as well. But I think first we need to tackle a little bit of lingo, because if you didn't know, snowboarding has its own language.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
I'm trying to learn Korean.
No,
now
Korean.
Now I got to learn Korean. Snowboarding.
Forget about Korean.
I'm basically an encyclopedia, so buyer beware.
We have to start I think a little quiz.
Bring it.
A little quiz. All right, and I'm going to start.
How many questions?
I'm going to start very easy on you. I want you to know. I'm going to go easy
on you. Don't say that, because if I get it wrong, then I look ridiculous.
Exactly. That's the point.
Awesome.
Okay, starting easy. I'm going to give you a gimme, the first one. Half pipe.
I mean.
Yeah.
Give me a little credit.
I mean, everyone knows.
They have the flat bottom with a rounded top. It's the structure that they use in all the gravity extreme sports. You're smiling. You're nodding your head.
I'm smiling.
Meaning you nailed
out
it,
of,
basically.
Out of a 10, you get a 7. I'm going to give you that. But it's a good start.
Okay.
It's a good start. Question number 2.
A C student. Go on.
Slope style.
Here's what I know about slope style. I know it was a new event in Sochi. Is that right?
It was.
I know it was a big hit. And it's basically like a big skate park in the snow.
Yes, it's got obstacles, it's got aerials, it's got jumps, and it's a combination of all three of those, of who's going to do the biggest tricks with the best style.
It's creative.
Creative, like
it's
yourself.
It's artsy.
Like yourself.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Say that again, I didn't hear you.
Question number 3, 1080.
I was under the impression there'd be no math, but...
You didn't read your contract.
Clearly
enough.
Not the fine print.
No.
Is it 360, 360, 360?
Yes.
Sorry about it.
Bingo. Yes.
3 for 3.
That's it.
Is me.
Yeah.
Perfection. You can't get better.
Nope.
Okay, smarty pants. You think you're so great. 2 can play this game.
Okay.
I have a quiz for you. It is just one question, and you must get it right or else you fail the test.
Bring
Are
it.
You ready?
Bring it. Yep.
Cork. Define cork.
Define
Not
cork.
What you're thinking.
Easy. Easy. The county in Ireland. No, it is
That's
an
where
off,
you went with it? What?
Cork is easy. It's an off-axis rotation. The guys use, they use their double corks, triple corks, and now some of these athletes are even pulling off quadruple corks.
You put your money where your mouth is.
That
Very
is
well
it.
Done.
You will see it firsthand.
We're 4 for 4 together.
That's it.
Go us.
I like it.
So basically, we are perfect in the quiz.
Yes. So we're ready. So you are
ready. For what?
I mean, listen, that's it. All the questions are answered. You're ready to go to Korea. But first, let's do this first.
Before you go, bring
we
your passport.
We are going to hear a lot more about 1080s from Todd Richards, who's going to take us back to the beginnings of snowboard and really kind of lay out in a conversation I had with him about the evolution of the sport and how it went from the backcountry to being basically one of the most popular events in the present Winter Olympics. Now, I am old enough that you were one of my heroes growing up when I was snowboarding back in the mid-80s. And you were one of the pioneers. So take us back to the mid-80s and the beginning of snowboarding culture. What was it like?
Well, I mean, you know, I was probably late second generation, maybe early third generation of snowboarding pros. And that means that I kind of came up, like I started snowboarding in 1984-85 season. And I mean, it was a struggle on the East Coast growing up to find a ski resort that would allow you to go snowboarding. There was a list that was published in the back of a Burton catalog that had all of the different ski areas that would allow you to go snowboarding. So just the art of trying to find a place to go snowboarding compared to how it is today, where, like, you know, resorts are catering to families to try to get them to come and learn how to ride together. It's a drastic difference. I mean, and there's people, you know, winning Olympic medals now. We were getting spit on off the chairlift. So there's quite the juxtaposition of attitudes.
I was living back at a basin in the day in the late 80s and snowboarding. And I remember getting some very strange looks from skiers. How were those early snowboarders? How were you guys perceived by the skiing crowd?
Well, look, I have to approach this in a new way now, just because I go snowboarding with my daughter or my son on the hill, and my sole purpose, besides trying to film them do things, is to protect them from other people flying down the hill. So I completely get it. We were out of control. The boards, the equipment was terrible. We didn't have a lot of control back then. And, you know, the skiers that were at the area were looking at us like hazards. And good God, we were. And it took me a long time to realize that, but we were a nightmare on the hill. And we were all coming from skateboarding backgrounds. A lot of us never really skied beforehand, so we didn't know the etiquette of ski areas. And, you know, we just came at it from a completely different angle. And we scared people. We were scary.
If I'm not mistaken, there was a story about snowboarding in Time magazine that you've talked about. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Time magazine, I forget what year it was, but it was probably around 1983, 1984, where Time magazine labeled us the worst new sport. So, and it was even to have, we thought it was a victory because Time magazine called it a sport. Because up until that point, it was just an activity. So we were like, yeah, Time magazine thinks we're a sport, even though it was like the full negative connotation of what was going on.
The small victories. Now, at that time, now, throughout the 80s and you know, by the time the first U.S. Open was conducted, at what point did you think that snowboarding could evolve from the fringe to the mainstream? Or did you think that at all?
I mean, I guess in the way that I look at it, like, snowboarding became a job when I got my first paycheck from a sponsor. And that, honestly, was when my parents saw this as something more than just me hanging out with my scumbag friends. It became money in the bank. Because up until that point, I wasn't particularly good at anything except for, like, maybe making a mess and coming home late. So I finally found something that I was good at, and that's kind of when things changed. I mean, snowboarding started to become more of a marketing force to the youth, and it was kind of a slow burn at first. But then, you know, it started with like maybe a Juicy Fruit commercial, and then maybe you'd see, someone snowboarding in like a Pop-Tarts commercial, and then it just kind of slowly became something that people were gravitating towards. And I mean, the early crowds at the U.S. Open were crazy. Hundreds of thousands of crazy people uncontained at Stratton Mountain, Vermont. And that was just like, that's when we kind of saw that this was, you know, this was something.
If the average listener, the average skier or snowboarder thinks of snowboarding, I think they naturally think of the Winter X Games. And you had a particularly fine highlight there by winning the halfpipe at the inaugural Winter X Games in 1997. What did that signify? What did that first X Game and the X Games signify for the changing of the sport, for action sports going mainstream?
Well, we had all watched the Summer X Games, or at that point just the X Games, and it was the brainchild of Ron Semio, and he wanted to showcase these, you know, quote-unquote extreme sports, although he never really admitted that the X Games, what the X stood for extreme. He always said that the X was for the unknown, these new unknown sports. So we were all fans of watching the skating in the summertime and, like, this big festival event that they treated the skaters and BMXers and whatever was going on there like royalty. Like, they treated us like real athletes instead of just like, you know, just not very well, like a lot of other events would treat us. So once they kind of shifted and they're like, we want to do the Winter X Games, it was a big deal because we knew about the coverage. We knew how the coverage was going to go. We knew it was a multi-day event where it was on ESPN every day for a week. Basically, like, you know, the run-up to it and then the weekend of actual competition. It was just cool. It was a lot more serious. Like, at that point, we hadn't had anything that was so serious before the X Games kind of came in for competition for us. That was the big deal.
And well, in 98, you also had a big deal, the Olympics. Tell us about that experience. How was that? I mean, that must have legitimized it to you. I mean, talk about your parents worried about you getting a paycheck representing your country.
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. As soon as we knew, there was rumors for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden it was like, the snowboarding is going to the Olympics. You guys are going to be the first Olympic team. It was the most stressful competition season of my entire life. Once I got to the Olympics, it was fine, but getting on the team, I've never been more nerve-wracked in my entire career, but it was such a big deal. And, you know, you want to talk about people coming out of the woodwork to interview you and getting exposure in different places that you never even dreamed possible. It was overwhelmingly nuts for myself.
Sure. And I think the next real step towards mainstream acceptance of snowboarding and action sports as a whole is the 2002 Olympics. And tell us about that. I mean, we had two aspects. We had Kelly Clark winning the gold medal, and you had the men's team sweeping all three events in the halfpipe. What was the significance of that? How did that change the game?
I think that in 1998, you know, we were kind of the guinea pigs. The day that we competed in halfpipe, it was pouring rain. Pretty much every other competition that day was canceled except for snowboarding. So it was like kind of just a really Debbie Downer moment in competitive snowboarding. So it left me with a really bad taste in my mouth. But then fast forward to Salt Lake City in 2002, it's a beautiful sunny day. It's warm out. Temperatures in the 40s. The way that the scaffolding and the audience there to watch the event, the way that the scaffolding was, it was like a gladiator pit. You know, the half pipe came down the middle. There was just fans everywhere. They were, you know, 30, 40 deep at the bottom. It was a completely different vibe. That was snowboarding.
Oh, and she's done it. Kelly Clark has done it. The first gold medal for the American team.
And just to have Kelly win and then to have the boys sweep, it was unbelievable. Like, the Red Hot Chili Peppers played in between the men's and the women's competition. It was everything that snowboarding was at that point, and just shown to the world in the most perfect conditions. And that's when things changed.
Those changes, what was the most definable? Was it more fans, a global appeal? And I assume it was the money and sponsors as well. Is there any way to really qualify those immediate changes?
It was all of those things and more. I mean, we had, you know, the guys that swept it, they were in like a Nestea commercial, like very shortly thereafter. Kelly Clark was paraded around on all of the evening talk shows. And it was the melding of pop culture and the late night shows and the media exposure that came along with it. I mean, we always had our sponsors, but it was the non-endemic sponsors that came in, and just the exposure to mainstream media and the mainstream media really getting behind it and being excited about it. I mean, it was crazy. You had guys like Dave Chappelle really excited about the men's. I mean, like, that was a massive moment for us in snowboarding. Like, Dave Chappelle was like our god at that point. We all memorized all of his specials. So, like, to have him at the bottom of the halfpipe, super stoked to meet the snowboarders was crazy.
Absolutely. And what about the money? Was there a noticeable change in bank accounts? I mean, were people making a good living at this point?
Yeah, I mean, those days, that was the salad days of snowboarding. I would say from about 1998 to about 2006, before the industry kind of tanked on itself, those were like the salad days. Like, people were making enough money to buy a house, to pay off the house, to go buy multiple cars, to just like live an athlete's lifestyle. It was definitely plush. It was great.
Talking about the mainstreaming of action sports, especially winter sports, there's one name that certainly comes to mind is Shaun White. And I don't think you can have a discussion without it. In 2010, he was on the cover of Rolling Stone. And I consider him the sort of first transcendent action sports star. Talk about the importance of Shaun White in sort of the action sports world going mainstream.
I think Sean is the first. He's basically like our LeBron James or our Michael Jordan as far as snowboarding goes. He was the first one to truly become iconic independent of the sport that he did.
Okay, here comes Shaun White on his victory lap, starting things off with an enormous run right there. This one basically is for the fans right now.
He mixed that talent and charisma, right? I don't think too many athletes in any sport come around that often with that sort of combination.
Yeah, because you have maybe one or the other. You're super talented, but maybe you cannot speak to save your life in front of other human beings. And Shaun was the perfect meld of being able to kind of carry a conversation, joke around with the late night host, joke around with the interviewers, and just really put it down when he needed to on the slopes. So he was, you know, the perfect storm for snowboarding at that point.
Was there any concern in the industry with your sort of ear to the ground? Was there any worry that it had gone too far? It had gone too mainstream? The sport had started out as this sort of rebellious activity and this rebellious vibe was now, you know, on the cover of a Wheaties box.
Right. Well, you know, be careful what you wish for, because all of us strive to be taken seriously and to be, you know, quote unquote, legitimate. But, you know, I've been saying this for a little bit, but as soon as your grandmother could learn how to snowboard in one day, snowboarding stopped being the cutting edge sport. And I think a lot of people had a hard time with that. There's a lot of people that are still trying to come to grips with that because they were so born and bred on this counterculture movement. But now it's been homogenized and it's definitely everyone's sport. And that's kind of the crux of it right now is like, how do we get back to its roots without sacrificing?
Do you predict that we'll see another Shaun White, a megastar within snowboarding? Because it seems the competition is so close these days and there's so much talent out there that for one to rise above the crop so dramatically seems daunting.
Well, I mean, at this point, who knows? But I mean, there's so many young kids coming up right now, and the average age of a A-list competitive snowboarder is 17. So we've seen a lot of potential. I don't really think an athlete in snowboarding really peaks until their mid 20s. So who knows? But in order to get where Shaun White is, you need to bring the charisma too. You need to have a personality that's just magnetic, and everyone wants to kind of be around you and follow what you're doing closely. I think that maybe we would see maybe more people in snowboarding that maybe gravitated towards filming and things to become a giant iconic figure. I don't know if we'll ever see it again. I think Chloe Kim is the closest that we're going to come to a new Shaun White, and that's on the women's side of things. So she could be the one to carry the torch.
I'm personally banking on a Todd Richards comeback. So I want you to know that that's where I'm putting my money into.
How good are you at holding your breath?
Todd, we look forward to seeing you on NBC for this upcoming Olympics, and we'll see you on the slopes.
All right, thank you, sir. There. All right.
Don't hold your breath. He told you, Tim.
I know.
I hear you listening to Todd. You're like a little kid with the excitement. You're a big fan, yeah?
Well, he was, when I was snowboarding in the mid-80s, he was one of the guys. He was the guy you would see in the magazines and hopefully see on TV, and really one of the pioneers.
It's a big sport. Every year, though, it seems bigger, it seems greater, it seems more extreme. Is that right?
Yeah.
By design?
I think it's a natural evolution. Back in the day, you know, the half-pipe walls were maybe 4 feet or 5 feet, and they were pretty curved. They weren't as flat. Now there are 22-foot walls, and athletes are getting like 30-foot aerials. It's bigger, it's more sensational, it's more dangerous, but it's become so popular that every year I just don't know where it's going to end.
Is snowboarding, Tim, about fitness? Because with basketball, with baseball, with tennis even, the more fit you are, the better you are at your craft. Is that the same with action sports or no?
I think it's changing. I think for the life of snowboarding since the mid-80s, I think for a considerable amount of that time, fitness wasn't a part of it. It was just getting time on the mountains. It was just repetitions in the half pipe. It was trying out new tricks. But I think, like all athletes, it's caught on with trainers, with dietitians, with really being in the best shape possible, because there's so much competition now. And the competitors are so close in ability that any extra edge you can get by hitting the weight room or running or stamina, strength, et cetera, is going to probably pay off in the end.
Combination of fitness and technique, really.
Totally.
Todd said, don't hold your breath for a Todd comeback. It was worth a try, right? You talk longevity. Kelly Clark is case in point.
Kelly Clark is just astounding.
Oh, my gosh. He throws a 700, 720 at the end of a run. Nothing to lose there.
Nothing to lose but grabbing gold.
She is going into her 17th year of competition. So here's Kelly Clark. She's a snowboarding legend who's the first woman to pull off a 1080 in competition. She's won 3 Olympic medals, and she's about to compete in her 5th Winter Olympic Games.
You know, snowboarding really isn't what it is today by any means. The first year I started snowboarding in 1990, it was the first year snowboarding was even allowed on my mountain. You know, back then the parks and the half pipe, they were for snowboarders only. I remember skiers used to drop their poles over the snowboard parks so they could go down and retrieve their pole and maybe hit a jump or two, because it just was not what you did when you were a skier. And it's honestly progressed a ton since then. I remember I watched my first Olympics when I was 14. I recorded it on a VHS tape and I watched it after school. And I remember, you know, I was like, this is what I want to do with my life. And I remember telling my parents, and my parents were great. They were like, you can do anything. You can be anything you want. And I was like, all right, I want to be a pro snowboarder. And they're like, yeah, that's not really a thing. Like,
maybe.
You're not doing that. Maybe think of something else.
Did you think this was a full-time job, a future career, a full-time job, or it was a transition to something else you want to do? I mean, did you see it happening, unraveling in a good way in front of your eyes, in a sense?
I mean, as any kid dreams, you dream about, you know, making it to the top. Not everybody does, but I definitely had those aspirations and those dreams. I remember my first X Games, you know, my longtime agent, Peter Carlisle, came into my parents' restaurant and they asked me, you know, what I planned to do. And I told them that I was going to, I planned on winning the Olympics. You know, that was in my mind what I was going to do. And at the same time, any time you pursue athletics, I don't think there's a guarantee. I don't think there's, you know, it's not a stable, sustainable, sure future. And so my parents, they gave me a 1-year trial period. They said, okay, you can defer from college for 1 year. Mm-hmm. That was the year of the 2002 Olympics. And I remember after I won the Olympics in 2002, the first thing I said to my father was, does this mean I don't have to go to college? Is this enough to prove that it was successful? Because, you know, back then when I was suggesting that I wanted to be a professional snowboarder, it just wasn't a thing. It was like, it just didn't even exist until the 2002 Olympics. And now it's so much different. You know, kids these days probably could say they wanted to be a professional snowboarder and we had something to kind of compare it to. But back then there just wasn't anything.
Was there any palpable, really noticeable change that you saw after the 2002 Olympics, let's say, or landing that 1080 where you said all of a sudden the phone was ringing off the hook, or, you know, Coca-Cola wanted to talk to, or were there any real significant change that, you know, was an aha moment to you? You said, oh, wow, this is it. We've made it.
You know, back when newspapers were a thing, they used to be on the side of the street in these boxes.
Oh, yes.
I remember after Salt Lake Games, I'd been doing media kind of around the clock after I won. And I went outside the next morning and there was a whole row of newspaper machines on the street. And I was on the cover of every single national newspaper. That was a moment for me where I thought, okay, this is a big deal. And this is really happening. And snowboarding is front and center in all of it.
Tim, I'm listening to you and I did a quick Google search in the process. Has Kelly Clark been competing longer than Chloe Kim's been alive? Is that right?
I think you are correct, yes.
And Kim's one of the most exciting riders today. I'm curious the difference between males and females in the sport.
I think the best way that listeners can find out about that is to tune in January 22nd for our Athletes to Watch episode, where one of the featured athletes will be Chloe Kim, and she will talk at length about the women's sport, the progress they're making in the women's sport, and the future of the women's sport in terms compared to the men.
How's that for a tease, ladies and gentlemen?
There is.
Well
tune
done.
In.
Tune in. One thing is for sure, it's equally as exciting to watch. Tim, thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it. I'm an expert. I feel like an expert at least.
You look like one.
Thank you so much. Fancy myself an expert. And I'm an even bigger fan of action sports after this conversation, so I appreciate it. You are listening to The Podium, and we are so glad you are. Our sound engineers, Miles Yule, Pedro Alvira, and Jonathan Hirsch. Thank you to them. Our senior producer is Golda Arthur, and our executive producer is Nishat Kerwa. And thank you for listening. Be sure and subscribe to The Podium on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your favorite shows. I'm Lauren Shahada. You're listening to The Podium. See you next time.